this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Most of the committees has lost the belief and the hope in the Democratic Party or in the Republican Party. I think by now it is time to organize, and we just have us and we don't have no one else.
President-elect Donald Trump has promised to carry out the largest deportation drive in U.S. history. Immigrants have been organizing to fight back.
There were a lot of people who were looking at what the Democrats did and said, well, that process is not fair.
International peace activist, former presidential candidate, and former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney shares her thoughts on Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris's defeat.
So what we've had is a profit-led inflationary spiral, not a wage-led one.
The inflation that working-class people face is one reason for the rejection of Kamala Harris, Marxist economist Michael Roberts explains. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to carry out the largest deportation drive in U.S. history, promising to deport as many as 10 million people and seriously threaten the rights of migrant communities. Jorge Torres is with the National Day Laborers Organizing Network and Radio Jornalera. He spoke at the People's Forum in New York City on a panel titled Why the Democrats Failed, How Trump Won, What is to be done?
I come to this space as an organizer. I was undocumented for more than 10 years. When I came to this country from Ecuador with my parents, I realized that it was supposed to be for a better life. But what I faced 25 years plus was that my parents couldn't find a stable job because we were undocumented, that I couldn't go to college because I didn't have papers, and we have dreams. My brother is still with DACA, and he's facing probably deportation after these elections. So I've been organizing since then, and now I organize with the National Day Labor Organizing Network, which is an organization across the country with more than 70-plus worker centers. And what we do is we organize from the bottom up with different type of workers, and especially day laborers, domestic workers, and low-income families as well. What we have seen after probably 2 months ago was that it was a lot of fear, and visiting day labor corners across the country was that people was super scared what was going to happen if Trump wins. After Trump wins, we have couple calls, Zoom calls, and workers actually were scared as a maximum level. And we were thinking, what is that we're going to do? And I remember Pedro, who came into this call, and he was the one who mentioned, we need to start organizing for real. We have to stop saying, el pueblo salva al pueblo, and it's just bullshit. The people save the people, and it's just bullshit. It's an slogan. What is that we're going to do for real? And we were in the middle of a call with almost 100 plus people, and we start thinking about it. How the hell are we gonna do this? And what is that? What does that mean when we say the people save the people or the el pueblo salva al pueblo? And we make a decision that it's about time to organize local communities and comités populares, popular committees across the country. We decide to organize popular assemblies across the country. And then around 1 month, we organized almost 25 assemblies across the country. Now we have, thank you. And now we have almost 45 plus committees leading by workers, leading by undocumented people, leading by people that really are the directly impacted and that are ready to work. What they are proposing with Project 2025 is basically four things. Number one, terminating all the deferred actions, TPS, DACA, DALE, which is a deferred action for labor enforcement. They want to terminate also any type of naturalization of undocumented people, which is like when you marry with someone that is undocumented and you have a baby, they want to terminate the naturalization as well, which is stupid. And Stephen Mueller just posted something today that he's going to do that in a turbo-fast manner the first 100 days. When Trump says that he's going to deport more than 11 million undocumented immigrants, he's not playing. He's really going to go against it. The second thing that they want to do is create local communities and local programs like 287 Jesus Secure Communities that allows police, local police, to be acting as immigration agents. The other thing that they want to do is, which is something that is really going to affect a lot of workers, and they want to amplify E-Verify, which is it is a system they're going to detect you when you go to work. They're going to detect you if you have papers or not, if you're undocumented or not. So that means that a lot of people that are already working you have to be able to work, they're going to be deported or they're going to be detained. They want to also implement almost 100,000 beds every day on the detention centers. So what we are trying to do is that proposal is basically creating local committees, comités populares, which is what we call in Spanish, comités populares or popular committees. I think that most of the committees has lost the belief and the hope in the Democratic Party or in the Republican Party. I think by now it is time to organize, and we just have us and we don't have no one else. Thank you so much.
That was Jorge Torres of the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, ENDOLON, speaking at the People's Forum in New York City on November 8th. Pablo Alvarado, co-director of ENDOLON, spoke to Zoe Alexandra of People's Dispatch about what Trump's victory means for immigrant communities across the United States and how communities are organizing to fight back.
For the last decade, the immigrant right, to the extent there is a movement, has been sort of led by Beltway organizations, by organizations in Washington, D.C., national organizations that are essentially an extension of the Democratic Party. And and when it comes down to choosing between party and immigrants, they always choose the interests of the party. So the first point of departure when we're having these assemblies is that we are on our own. That the Democrats, when they have had the power and the political clout to actually use it to benefit immigrants, they have decided not to use it, but to use their political capital for other priorities that they have. And I'm not saying that the other priorities are bad, like healthcare and other priorities, you know, the economy. I'm not saying that. But this is a political decision that they've made. And of course, you know, and every time they're running, they tell you, well, I'm going to do immigration reform in the first 100 days, you know, and they end up not doing it. And of course, I remember, and we have to remember moments in history that are, I would say, emblematic of what has happened. I remember that the first time that Trump won and he began putting little kids in cages, I remember a lot of white liberals coming out and standing with us and you know, crying, and obviously, you know, it was welcome, and crying about the fact that kids being put in cages. And of course, that sentiment, who wouldn't cry, who wouldn't feel sad seeing little kids in cages, you know? But right immediately after Biden wins, that support, that movement fully dissipated. And it's not that the kids were reunified with their parents. In fact, the majority of kids who were separated by Trump at that time have not been reunified with their parents. So the point of departure of every Asamblea Popular that we have is we assume undisputable truths. And that is one undisputable truth, that there is not going to be a champion, there is not going to be a politician, there is not going to be a savior, there is not going to be an organization or a supreme leader that's going to come and save people. And part of that, there is a very famous common saying in Latin America, solo el pueblo salva al pueblo, only the people save the people. And we know that to be true in every moment of a struggle, you know. So we're telling people, you're in your own. This time, we're gonna build a strategy that is from the bottom up, not from the top down. in the past, groups have, that particularly the national organizations that are an extension of the Democratic Party, they have used the field, as they called local immigrant rights organizations. And they tell them, okay, here are your talking points, and here is $2,000. Go and do a press conference and bring the poor immigrants to share their stories. And it's from an angle of pity. And now if you go to the other side, all you see that comes out of their mouths is like pure hatred. So immigrants are between the pity of some and the scorn of others. And this debate around immigration has been within that dichotomy, within those two, you know, poles, like those who pity immigrants and those who hate immigrants. But immigrants have been absent of that conversation. And the idea of building, you know, self-protection committees across the country is that we're going to fill that vacuum and the people will speak for themselves. Part of what's been wrong about the so-called immigrant rights movement, to the extent that there is one, is that there are too many intermediaries. There's too many people speaking on behalf of immigrants. And, you know, immigrants have a voice. Immigrants are very smart people. And definitely we can defend ourselves. So that's the point of the partial. That's where we engage people in the process of discussion. Now, after the election, you know, today we're having our national call with our membership. And of course, you know, there is fear. There's frustration, there's sadness, there's anger. All of those sentiments are all within ourselves. I mean, I have them. But we cannot resist, we don't resist those sentiments. We resist the adversary. You know, and we have to embrace the fact that those sentiments exist. Now we're gonna organize ourselves to make sure that, because the only way that Trump can fulfill the promise of deporting millions of people is if he enlists local police departments and sheriff departments to enforce immigration law. So we're going to pose the dilemma to local elected leaders. Are you going to protect the residents of your community, or are you going to line up with extreme MAGA, with ideology? Are you going to participate in this mass deportation operation that Trump is talking about? You know, so we're going to make sure that our resistance is tangible, and that not only people come together to raise money to assist families that are in deportation proceedings or to monitor where there is ICE activity, but also to push local elected officials so they do the right thing, you know. And the fact is that, you know, over half of immigrants live in cities, in states, in counties, regions where there are layers of protection that establish a line between local law enforcement and immigration law enforcement. And the reason why Mr. Trump couldn't deport as many people as he would have liked to deport during his first term is because these sanctuary policies exist. You know, so we're going to make sure that these policies continue to exist, and that we overcome the dichotomy of living within pity and scorn.
That was co-director of the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, Pablo Alvarado, speaking to Zoe Alexandra of People's Dispatch. That was Partisano, performed by Tenzin Choigyal and Leo Heiblum. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Next, J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio speaks to international peace activist, former presidential candidate, and former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney about Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party's defeat in the 2024 elections.
Well, first question that I wanted to ask you, I know that you are one of the most dynamic members that Congress has ever had, and you were at one time registered as a Democrat. The Democrats are who basically put Kamala Harris up to go against Trump. From your time in the Democratic Party, what do you think that the problem was? Why did Kamala Harris lose?
Well, Kamala Harris lost because she wasn't qualified to have the position. And there were a lot of people who were looking at what the Democrats did and said, well, that process is not fair. But, of course, the Democrats haven't had a fair process since when? Not even when I was there was their process fair, because they always supported candidates against me. And Democrats, you know, the Democratic Party was supposed to be neutral in a primary and let the people speak, but that was never the case even with me. So here you go with the so-called Democratic Party that's supposed to be small D Democratic, and yet they're blocked candidates who might have wanted to run for the Democratic nomination, but they weren't even given a chance to do so. So basically what I teach my students is that we've got the colonized, neo-colonized, neoliberalized world. And of course, we in the United States are subjected to that, where everything, every aspect of our lives has become a profit center for somebody. And it's a darn near impossible for us to hold a job that will allow us to actually thrive instead of just survive. And so that is the nature of neoliberalism, as that is also, according to Thomas Piketty, the nature of capitalism. So, you know, we need to start questioning the economic organization of the state. If it can't deliver health care, it can't deliver decent education, it can't deliver the things that a state is supposed to deliver, then why do we have that state? And if that state can't deliver it or won't deliver it, then we need to get a different type of state, a different kind of political system, maybe. And that is, I think, what Thomas Jefferson said, that, you know, a good, little bit of revolution every 20 years, every generation, right. I think he said, is a good thing. So that certainly is true for the African-American community, but, you know, we haven't done our own little rebellion in order to demand more from those who are able to do more. So anyway, we've got that scenario going on, and I have a template that I show my students for the structural violence, the cultural violence that we assume is normal, but it's not normal, and we shouldn't normalize things that aren't normal, really. And so we've got that going on, and at the same time, there's another template that I give my students, and then we sort of try and figure it out, who's sitting at the table. So the second template is my template for global social control. And I use the COVID example and that experience as an example of how this kind of operates, because you can look at some of the statements that have been made by the World Economic Forum and those people who were sort of took a leadership role in promoting the shots, the injections, promoting the fear, the campaign for social distancing, wearing masks, all of that entire phenomenon. And even recently, what you've had are statements like, oh, the amount of conformity was unbelievable. This was like a test. I think it was coming out of World Economic Forum that they said it was like a test, and they were shocked that people were so compliant. And then, of course, you've got the Borla, the Pfizer CEO, quoted as saying that the amount of compliance is going to even increase when they're able to do these nano bot capsules that automatically release the substance into the bloodstream. And all you have to do is take it one time or accept it, you know, one time, this little nanobot thing, and then it goes on, I guess, for the rest of your life, releasing this stuff, wow. Kind of like what the injections do. So what I ask my students, so I draw a table, because, you know, a lot of these decisions are actually made around a table. And I have 26 people sitting around the table, and these 26 people basically control 7 billion people on the planet. COVID is the example of that. And now, who were these people? Well, one of the individuals that readily comes to mind is Tedros, right?
Right.
So Tedros at the World Health Organization is the face of this whole COVID compliance, take your shots and get on the ventilator and blah, 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 all of that. All of that was Tedros, but Tedros is not the brains behind it. So there have got to be other individuals who are sitting around the table, and they're directing what Tedros was telling to the rest of the world. So now, once we start to say, okay, so now who might those persons have been? Well, one of them we know from the statement that came out of the Pentagon is that the U.S. military is sitting right next to Tedros because they bragged about they were able to design and then deploy these injections for people, and people actually took them. And what World Economic Forum was saying was, well, these people took this and they didn't even know what was in it, and we marvel at the level of compliance that we were able to get. So now we know that World Economic Forum is sitting at the table. Who else might be sitting at the table? Well, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation must be sitting at the table, because now all of a sudden everybody is being told you got to get an injection for this and you got to get an injection for that. And we want to put the injection material in your food. So we'll put it in the lettuce, we'll put it in the vegetables, we'll put it, and Bill Gates is buying agricultural land. So right. Now Bill Gates has definitely got to be a player at the table. Who else might be at this table? Well, we know that BlackRock owns just about every corporation that exists, well, particularly the Fortune 500 corporations. So BlackRock is definitely at the table. So, you know, you start to think about who's at the table for a particular issue, who's at the table for every issue. So now we can understand who the organizers of global social control are. They aren't the 1%. They're like the 1/10 of the 1%. And, you know, they're, like I depict, 25, 26 people sitting around the table deciding this. Now, every state, we have roughly 200 states on the planet, so every state has one of these, a replicate of this for themselves. And so we would have that for the United States as well. Now, if we have World Economic Forum, BlackRock, we've got Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we've got U.S. military and others, other entities sitting around the table, and they're sitting around the global social control table, and then we've got another table where these entities that basically control the United States, they have their own table, as U.S. is one of the 200 states on the planet. Okay, so then what does really Trump and Kamala really mean in the scheme of things? They are equivalent on the U.S. level to Tedros and his role on the global level. So now they aren't the brains behind any operation that's going to take place. They are the faces. They are the public faces of those people who are sitting around the table and deciding what's going to happen in the United States. So so does it really matter whether it's Kamala or Trump? Not really. You know, maybe the 26 people are sitting around the table have divided into two factions. And so there's a Trump faction, there's a Kamala faction. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're not fighting really. Why? Because both factions are going to get what they want.
Right.
And that's what we have to understand.
Can you talk a little bit about AIPAC? I know that you, in your political career in Congress, came up against AIPAC. Can you tell people who is AIPAC? Can you tell the people how they got so ingrained in the U.S. political system?
Well, now, this is the thing that is so amazing and astounding. So, you know, if I'm elected to the Knesset in Israel, there is absolutely no way that I can have a dual passport sort of life. I have to choose, if I'm in the Knesset, I have to choose my Israeli passport, and I have to relinquish any passport that I might have from any other state. Well, in the United States, it's quite different. People who have multiple passports, meaning that they're citizens of multiple states, can actually serve in the United States Congress. Now, there's no group that has perfected this more than the pro-Israel lobby. And AIPAC is sort of like, you could say they're the head, or maybe they're the, maybe they're the head of the pro-Israel lobby. You would have the Anti-Defamation League. Maybe that would be the heart of the pro-Israel lobby. So you've got all of this. And then you've got these individuals who act on behalf of the pro-Israel lobby, even though they are not necessarily affiliated with any particular organization. So this is a fight that has been going on probably for all of the life of the United States as a state, but certainly within my lifetime, this is what JFK, President Kennedy, was trying to control, because nuclear secrets had been stolen from the United States and operatives inside the U.S. government were actually sharing those bad information with Israelis. And President Kennedy was trying to get Israel to, well, basically declare its nuclear intentions and then submit itself for inspections like the rest of the world does. And the partisans who support Israel inside the United States government fought tooth and nail to prevent Kennedy from doing that. Well, we know what happened to President Kennedy. He had his brains blown out in full, broad open daylight in the middle of the day in front of the entire world. So we haven't had very many presidents since President Kennedy who have tried to tame the beast that is Israel. And of course, now, of course, that culminates with an outright genocide. It's not anything new, because the Israelis have been controlling every aspect of the life of the Palestinians. But now with this table that I'm talking about of global social control, individuals who want to control 9 billion people and then decrease that population down to 500 million, we must understand who those people are and what their goals are.
Trump has been selected to be the president of the United States. What do you forecast the next 4 years being like inside the United States?
Here you've got Elon Musk. What did he give? He gave $10 million for 5 months or so. You've got Miriam Adelson. She gave $100 million in one. Well, actually, I think it was 2 or 3 checks, but she gave $100 million. These people have a vested interest, and they are a part of that pro-Israel lobby that we were talking about. So will Israel strike Iran? I mean, remember, Trump is a war criminal. He killed Soleimani, and he did that in the midst of the impeachment. And then afterwards, he said, I did it because I was afraid I'd get impeached if I didn't do it. So clearly, there were people sitting around that table, that figurative table
people of global social control that were sitting around that table, and they were saying, this is what we want you to do. And then Trump did it because he didn't have the courage to not do it.
That was international peace activist, former presidential candidate, and former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney speaking to Block Report's J.R. Valray.
Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said they shot him in his head. Shot in the head to save his country. A shot in the head to save his country. Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real.
That was Gil Scott-Heron. Did you hear what they said? The University of California has spent millions of dollars on military weapons to put down campus protests in support of Palestine. On November 11th and 12th, UC students, faculty, and workers protested outside the UC Regents meeting at the San Francisco Mission Bay campus. Here's Jack, a UC Santa Cruz student, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
And you were involved in this tribunal, UC People's Tribunal on Palestine. What is it all about?
It is all about identifying and naming the people that are responsible for the UC financing the ongoing genocide in Palestine and holding them accountable using the power of the people.
And where does the Dillard Foundation stand in relationship to this, what's going on at UC?
Well, here at UCSF, the Helen Dillard Foundation has donated over $1 billion to UCSF medical facilities. At my campus at UCSC, the Helen Dillard Foundation has been a major donor of our Jewish Studies Department and our UCSC Foundation. And all the while, the Helen Dillard Foundation donates money to several Zionist groups, several pro-Israel groups, and even registered hate groups registered by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
And so this has been organized. There have been attacks on the students, and at the tribunal yesterday, there was quite shocking testimony about the brutality and torture of UC students at Santa Cruz. What happened there? And it seems like they targeted you and other students who were active protesting the genocide in Gaza.
I was there for part of the raid on May 30th and May 31st. I fortunately did not get brutalized or arrested, but a lot of my friends were very heavily brutalized by police. Over 100 students, faculty, and community members were arrested. They held the line from around like midnight to going into the early hours of like 7, 8 a.m. the next day. Detainees were denied food and water. They were subject to psychological torture on loop buses that were being converted to use as detainment wagons for students. Many of my friends suffer from permanent nerve damage and physical injuries from their assault by police officers. Many of my other friends are still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from their experience. And many, many students are still dealing dealing with the legal repercussions of being arrested and are being targeted further by the university for their involvement in the encampment.
And it sounds like the university management and the regents really want to crush this opposition. Is that true?
Yes, it's absolutely true. They're doing everything in their power to suppress student organizing. They've tried taking legal action against organizers. They have increased police surveillance at UC campuses. They've instilled new very suppressive time, place, and manner ordinances that aim to try to, like, control where free speech can happen. But, I mean, as we all know, that defeats the point of having free speech. And all the while, the UC, especially UC Santa Cruz, is using student activism and student organizing as part of their marketing campaign. And all over UCSC, you'll see these signs that say, you know, the real change is us, and that we're the original authority on questioning authority. And it really is just very insulting, because after our encampment was destroyed by the police and our, like, community members were brutalized and assaulted by them for hours, the police took down all of the art that was made at the base of campus in support of the encampment and replaced it with this big university banner that said, "The real change is us."
And this, you have now the Trump administration who want to shut down ethnic studies.
Yeah.
They want to shut down really what they call is wokeism, is learning about the real history of people, including Palestinians and the people of California. What should be organized against them? Because it seems like the regents and the management have a similar aim.
Yeah, it is. It's really, really scary. And I think a lot of people are very reasonably anxious and concerned about the future of our country, especially our education. But right now, we just need to mobilize in all areas and take matters into our own hands. And if our institutions and our systems are going to fail us, we have to reject them. And that's going to mean creating our own accessible curriculums for people, promoting education, not just through schools, but just, like, on our own, and mobilizing people who are interested in providing these resources, because clearly our government isn't going to provide them.
That was Jack, a UC Santa Cruz student, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer at a rally for Palestine outside the UC Regents meeting in San Francisco.
From Brooklyn, by the way of Palestine, is Suher Hamad.
Thank you guys so much. I will not dance to your war drum. I will not lend my soul nor my bones to your war drum. I will not dance to your beating. I know that beat. It is lifeless. I know intimately that skin you are hitting. It was alive once, hunted, stolen, stretched. I will not dance to your drummed up war. I will not pop, spin, break for you. I will not hate for you or even hate you. I will not kill for you, especially I will not die for you. I will not mourn the dead with murder nor suicide. I will not side with you or dance to bombs, because everyone is dancing. Everyone can be wrong. Life is a right, not collateral or casual. I will not forget where I come from. I will craft my own drum. Gather my beloved near, and our chanting will be dancing. Our humming will be drumming. I will not be played. I will not lend my name nor my rhythm to your beat. I will dance and resist, and dance and persist, and dance. This heartbeat is louder than death. Your war drum ain't louder than this breath.
That was Deaf Poetry, Suher Hamad, What I Will. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Inflation is one of the main reasons voters have given for their rejection of Kamala Harris and the Democrats. Marxist economist Michael Roberts discussed its causes and the escalating tariff trade war. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
What has happened over the last 2 years or so is a massive increase in prices across the board, but particularly in areas where the average household will see the effect on the buying and for food and basic necessities in the stores and in the malls, but also the increase in the cost of the insurance, of the interest on their credit cards, and all the utilities that are involved, all have gone up pretty hugely, as we know, over the last 2 years. On average, the official rise in prices over the last 2 years or so is about 22% in the US, which, by the way, in Europe is broadly the same. In the UK, for example, it's almost exactly the same. And that's the average rise in prices, which is not going back down again. We have low inflation. All that means is we're no longer rising, having prices rising at 8 or 10% a year. Now they're rising at 2 or 3% a year, possibly a little higher in the next few years if the policies of the new administration are applied properly. But we've had a big increase in the level of prices, and people are struggling to cope with that. And particularly for the poor income households, where basic foodstuffs have risen more. The increase in food prices over the last 2 or 3 years is bigger than 22%, is more like 24% or even more higher. And all those other utilities and insurances which people have to have also increased significantly over that period. So it is a real hit to the standards of living for the average American household. And it hasn't been compensated for sufficiently by increases in wages and earnings for the majority of households across America until very recently. Only just now we're beginning to see, with the inflation rate down to about 3% or so, that wages are getting above that. But you've lost 2 years of incomes in many ways. People are down 5, 6, 10% on their incomes compared to where they were just after the pandemic. So it's no wonder that there has been no enthusiasm for voting for the incumbent administration of the Democrats, especially when they start claiming everything is so fantastic. One of the claims they made was America's growing faster than the rest of the major economies in Europe. Well, I don't think that has much attraction with the ordinary American household to know that it's even worse in Europe, which I have to tell you it is. So that's not much of an argument to expect to vote for. And that's why I think the Democrats have lost that 10 million votes that they had when Biden was elected in 2020. Because Trump's vote's about the same as last time, but the Democrats have lost 10 million votes, plus people who just didn't bother to vote. You know, the working class people, unfortunately, the large numbers of them don't bother to register or even vote, something like 30 to 40% every time we have a presidential election, even more when we have a congressional one.
And of course, you don't have a working class a political alternative in the United States. You have two capitalist parties. They spent $12 billion on this election, and the working class obviously did not see a real political alternative. Now, the Democrats have said that one of the promises of Harris that she would control inflation and go after corporations who are raising their prices. And of course, we know that packages have gotten smaller and smaller, but the price stays the same or increases. So for the working class, it seems like the capitalists are in charge, and they've increased their profits during this past period. And can you talk about that and inflation? What causes inflation, and what can the working class to deal with inflation?
Well, one of the things we've noticed over this 2.5 year inflationary spike, which not just in the US, but in Europe and elsewhere, one of the features, what has been the biggest proportion of the increase in that price, say of 25% over the last 2 years? It's been in corporate profits. Corporate profits have contributed something like 60% of that increase in price. The other 30% is coming from increases in energy prices that we have to import from abroad, or food and so on. So sort of raw materials and things that were consumed both in factories and offices, but also at home. That's the other 30%. So only 10% has been due to any wage increases. Although we are always told by the officials, whether it's the Federal Reserve or the government, or in the case of where I am, the Bank of England particularly tells us, that the problem is that workers have been asking for too much wages, because it's absolute nonsense. What's happened is the big corporations in particular have hiked up their prices to take advantage of this situation and increase their profits dramatically. So when Kamala Harris said she was wanting to put some sort of controls on what she called price gouging, that's companies taking unfair increases. Apparently there are fair increases, but unfair ones. You wanted to control us. That was a bit like saying that the horse, that's after the horse has bolted, that she wants to close the doors. It's too late. We have 25% increase in inflation and huge rises in corporate profits. And then she says, if I'm elected, I'm going to do something about it. Well, yeah, all she would do is sustain the high level of prices that you've already got. So it wasn't a very convincing program to present. So what we've had is a profit-led inflationary spiral, not a wage-led one. And that's worth saying at this point, Steve, because the listeners want to know that the mainstream economic argument for inflation is twofold. There are two reasons for inflation, according to the mainstream and the conventional economics. One is that too much money is pumped into the economy. So there's too much money supply. The banks have got the interest rates, the central bank or the Federal Reserve got the interest rate too low, or they're printing too much money. And because there's not enough goods being produced to match it, then you get inflation. That's one argument. Although we've had a big rise in money supply over the last 10 years. And for until we got to the pandemic, there was hardly any inflation at all. All that money did was go into the financial sector, hoarded by the banks or spent on speculation on the stock market and the bond market. So it didn't end up. It was a great boom for the very well-off who invest. The 9% of people in the US who actually have investments worth what bothering about. But for the 90% of other households, it had no effect. Then we had the inflationary spiral afterwards. Now, the other reason for inflation, we're told, is because workers ask for too much wages and they force prices up because the companies have to raise their prices to compensate for increased wages to maintain their profits. Well, there's no necessary reason why they should maintain their profits. It's only we have a system where you have to maintain your profits if anything gets done in the countries like America. We have a capitalist system, so that's the way it works. Those two arguments actually have borne no empirical validity over the last 30 or 40 years. I'm old enough to remember the 1970s. And in the 1970s, we had sharp price rises as well, but we also had increased unemployment and not any wage increases at all. We had the opposite of what was argued in that case, no wage increases, and we still had inflation. So there's what was called stagflation in those days, no growth, but inflation, and that disproved the idea that it's wage increases that cause price rises. So what does cause inflation? Well, I think there are two things here. It's perhaps a more complicated thing to discuss, but I would say, if I try to put it simply, is to say that if an economy is not growing very fast, if it's struggling to grow, if it's not expanding sufficiently to provide all the things that social things that and supply that people need, and if people have money in their pockets, particularly after the pandemic, when there were many people locked up with put in their savings, so lots of people had to go and spend and work during COVID, but the sizable section of the households got money from the government, which they couldn't actually spend except on goods. They couldn't spend it on services, on restaurants, on flying anywhere and so on. But as soon as that was released, then all those industries that relied on those sorts of services have been so shrunk down that they couldn't respond to this. So there's a massive rise or the opportunity for companies to boost their prices dramatically. So it's the combination of if you've got a poor economy that's not productively growing fast, and then you get a burst of money but for whatever reason that comes into the system, then it drives up prices. And that's what we've seen over the last 2 years. What's the answer to this? Well, the answer to this, if an economy is properly, productively growing so that there's an increase in resources across the board because there's proper investment, proper government support for investment, and that provides the opportunity for people to get better wages, then economies can grow with higher wages, which are not affected by inflation. But that's not what's happened to the majority of the major economies in Europe and in North America in the last 2.5 years.
And the issue of the United States is the deindustrialization of the United States, when large amounts of the industry were shipped out first to the South, then to Mexico, then to Asia. And now the Trump administration say that they're going to make America great again by having tariffs and forcing production back into the United States. First of all, what is that all about? Because both capitalist parties were in favor of NAFTA, were in favor of exporting capital and having a global economy where they could pit workers against workers around the world for increased profits. So this whole effort to have tariffs and the likelihood of trade war, what is that about in relationship to capitalism and capitalist inter-imperialist?
As you said, Steve, one of the big things that happened in the second half of the 20th century from about the 1980s onwards, after the huge manufacturing slump that we had in America and Canada and Europe, if those who can remember in the smokestack industries and in the the steel belt and the coal belt in the US, the old heavy industries, that was wiped out. And what happened was that capitalists decided that they could make much better profits if they shifted all their manufacturing and their industry over to Asia, to Latin America and so on, where they could get very cheap labor. And they could also use the latest technology. They didn't have to use the old technology. They could bring the new technology into places like China and into Brazil and so on, to the best, the latest car factory and with the cheapest labor, so they could make massive profits. So we had this, what was called globalization, which is a front term for saying that capitalists decided to ditch North America and Europe and shift to the poorest countries in the world, exploit them hard and use the new latest technology. So you had this huge increase in trade, but it was what that led to was quite a holding down of prices, because manufacturing goods consumed by people in North America and elsewhere, all our TVs and all the rest of it, suddenly were being produced abroad at a much cheaper price, and they could flood the market at low prices. So a lot of things kept prices down as a result of that. But then what we've just seen since the 21st century is that this situation actually led to a massive rise, in particular with the Chinese economic system. They have dramatically increased their manufacturing, their exports, in not just in basic goods like originally with the TVs and all the rest of it, but now into high technology goods, where they do all the usual things that Americans used to do with their smartphones, with their iPads, all that. Chinese can do that cheaper. And above all, with electric vehicles, they are smashing the world market at the moment, because they've delivered them. You get a Tesla, mate, it costs you, who knows, I don't know what it costs in the States, but it's quite expensive. If the Chinese are allowed to import their Chinese EV, it's way cheaper and better. So they're really just smashing the rest of the advanced countries' manufacturing sector. Germany is in deep trouble as a result of this now. So that situation cannot be allowed to continue. That's what is frightening, not just the new Trump administration, but the old administration under Biden, where we've had a series of tariffs as well, and in Europe. So now the big battle is a complete reversal. As you say, Trump wants to friendshore, that's the phrase we use in economics. He's going to put manufacturing with our friends, not with China, and preferably actually in the US itself. And he's telling countries like Europe and Taiwan, if you go on trading with China, we're going to put the whip onto you guys, and you're going to have to change that policy. So you've got to sanction China, you've got to block their trade, you've got to stop everything, go further than that, to surround them as well militarily, and basically try to strangle the Chinese economy, because it's damaging, as the administration sees here, in the UK and the US, it's damaging the future of American capitalism and British capitalism. They can't be allowed to continue any further into the 21st century. And that's the big struggle. So we're going to see a massive increase in tariffs. For listeners, what that means is you buy goods in the shops now, but they're going to slap, if it's a Chinese good, 60% more on the price of that good. Now, that means if you continue to buy it, it's really hitting you in terms of the cost to do so. And if you don't buy it, you won't be able to get it. You'll have to buy. So you'll have to buy a Tesla or a much more expensive American commodity that's been produced at home, because you cannot afford even to buy the Chinese one, or it's not even available anymore because it's been banned, and that, which applies to phones and other things. That's the battle that's now going to happen. This is going to damage the world's economy, because if we don't trade and improve and raise productivity and cooperate together internationally, then it's very difficult for the world economy as a whole to expand. And if we start applying these sorts of restrictions, it was just going to make it worse, particularly for poorer people. It's going to make it difficult for the poor people of the peripheral world in India and China and Latin America, because they'll lose their exports and revenues. And it's going to make it much more expensive for us in North America and Europe. But that policy is one that's going to be applied, because the people who run our countries, the billionaires, the industrialists, the bankers, and the politicians are desperate to do something about China.
That was Marxist economist Michael Roberts speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, J.R. Valray, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.